I'm Jim DeBacchus on the left.
Greg Hughes on the right.
And Natalie Gochner in the political center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. This week, we will talk about the defanging of Utah's immigration law. More missteps by the DABC. Can you imagine no beer at Oktoberfest? And Mark Shurtleff goes on the offensive on Capitol Hill. But first, this news. I'm Natalie Gochner, and you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Good morning. We're going to have a lively and informative conversation about politics and current issues facing the state of Utah. I am joined on the political left by Senator Jim DeBacchus. Welcome, Jim.
Good morning, Natalie.
And on the political right by State Representative Greg Hughes. Welcome, Greg.
Good morning, Natalie.
Well, busy week in politics, and one of the things that caught my eye was our former Attorney General Mark Shurtleff showing up on Capitol Hill this week. The courage that it would take to walk into a law enforcement committee, sit on the second row with his daughter as the legislature, you know, grills or talks to the Department of Public Safety about the execution of the search warrant. Greg, what did you make of this, and were you there?
I was not there, but news traveled very quickly that our former Attorney General was present. You know, there's a lot of controversy there. Everybody knows about it.
You get a text that says, "But wow, Shurtleff's here today."
I had some colleagues mention it, and it was just a little bit, given all the attention to our two former Attorney Generals and the warrants that have been executed and some of the rumors that are out there. It was a bit surprising, but our former Attorney General, three-term Attorney General, was very upset with the way the search warrant was executed. He was not in town at the time and said that automatic weapons were drawn on his daughter, his young daughter. She was present at the committee hearing as well. Felt that it was very, very heavy-handed. Public safety director said that they did not execute the warrant. The FBI did. They were not present at the committee. And so they really threw their arms up as to say, we don't know how that was handled.
This was an FBI activity.
Yeah, they secured the area, and we came in after they had executed the warrant. So apparently Mark Shurtleff was incredulous at the test. He thought that the testimony was not sincere or forthcoming. He felt that this was a wrong committed upon him and his family.
Jim, did you get a little note slipped to you that said Shurtleff's in the building, or how did it happen in your world?
You just told me. Hughes never forwards it on to me.
Those
guys are
networked.
Gossiping, and they got those two thumbs going, and I'm just going, what's going on here?
The lonely life of a Democrat on Capitol Hill.
Look, what? I mean, I think this goes as much to the legislature as anything in the coddling and protection and cover things up and make sure that story doesn't get out, and let's make sure this whole Shurtleff swallow thing is managed, and let's not let anybody know what's going on. All of these, when is the first time we've ever heard from Shurtleff or Swallow in open hearing where questions could be asked? It's when he's complaining that law enforcement was mean to him. I mean, you would have thought that once during this process, with a legislative responsibility to look into what happens, there would have been once where the Attorney General or his predecessor would have been there in open public hearing to talk about what happened. But even when we goaded the legislature into having these hearings, they were secret star chamber. We still don't know what the heck happened in there. So my criticism of the legislature for a two-bit hearing process that didn't enlighten the public one bit, and then they, as soon as something bad happens to him, somebody makes a phone call and Shurtleff is given a platform to whine and complain about the way the thing was served. It was bad all around.
You have any sort of rebuttal there, Greg?
Well, look, I'm a big... As a conservative, I pay attention to civil liberties, and I think that the way that search warrants are executed generally probably leave the person where that search warrant's being executed feeling a little bit harshly treated.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, I don't know. I felt that it was a strange venue, but you know what? It shows his courage. With all the arrows he's taking, for him to come and sit on that second row and make his case and eyeball to eyeball with anyone asking— to me, it says that the man isn't ashamed of anything.
Yeah.
He doesn't have anything to hide.
I served on Capitol Hill with him for maybe, 4 years. And and then have done some work trying to help with immigration reform. And I would describe Mark Shurtleff as a bit of a warrior, someone mm-hmm. who will persevere and has some bravado about him, and yeah. he's showing that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Senator Urquhart said this in his Facebook. When Bennett got damaging records showing pay-for-play in the AG's office, Shurtleff immediately went on Doug Wright's show to say that he was dropping out of the U.S. Senate race, giving up his lifetime ambition because his daughter was having mental, emotional problems. Cruel, cruel behavior to huck his daughter under the bus. And so you've got to look, I think, and take that into consideration when you look at him appearing. You can't be a victim, you know? Yeah. You need to be out there. Who knows how many search warrants he signed, and you got to be a big player.
I think we just learned, though, how Jim networks. It's through watching whatever someone posts on Facebook.
I'm glad that Senator Urquhart is your North Star, Jim. I'm glad that you're watching Senator Urquhart. You keep doing that. He's a good state senator.
We saw something else happen this week that's just sort of interesting. That is that a judge took the HB 497, the immigration enforcement law, and the way the Salt Lake Tribune captured it, they said he defanged it. And essentially put up a lot of guards against rogue cops in his ruling. Greg, I understand you were a co-sponsor of that?
That's right. There was a number of co-sponsors of this bill. This bill, there was a lineup of people that wanted to... Look, here's the thing. In 2011, when we were running this bill, and the sponsor is former House member Steve Sandstrom.
Candidate for Congress.
That's right. He, you know, the frustration was, if you get a speeding ticket or you're pulled over by the police, there seems when you hand your driver's license over, some thorough... checking of that ID. You sit there for a while. The idea that we had people living here undocumented or illegal, where that whole process was being ignored while other law-abiding citizens sat and waited through that process, the law was basically saying, verify identification like we do with everyone. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew someone from out of town, from Boston, who jaywalked across the street to a sports bar to watch the NBA Finals and was ticketed and felt harassed for jaywalking, and his ID was taken and all the search done. The idea that there would be any double standard in that process offended many. And yeah. So we said, look, keep it all the same.
Have a uniform approach. You feel okay about the ruling?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, and I think when they say undue, you can't hold someone for an undue amount of time. I'm held for an undue amount of time if I get caught speeding and I sit there and wait. We all sit and wait for a while. So as long as it's even... You're two-way cool. street, everybody gets treated the same, I'm cool.
Jim, how'd you view this ruling?
Good. I think, with all apologies to Representative Hughes, who normally is out of line, but in this case particularly seems to have crossed over, the horror that this would have created in the lives of so many God-fearing, rural-living Utahns who now need not fear being charged with a misdemeanor or a felony simply for driving their parents to the grocery store or a friend to church, to have that horror lurking every moment, it was too much, and I think the judge saw it the right way.
But make no mistake, if they've been pulled over, if someone that's undocumented has been pulled over while operating a motor vehicle for the same reason any of us would, researching their identification or verifying who they are should be the same process. And if you cannot, there ought to be the same consequences as if anyone else who had identification with a problem when right. looking up that person, it ought to apply to all.
Yeah. You know, from the political middle, I would just say that I'm happy that the judge ruled in the way he did. And I think that enforcement, strict, strident-type enforcement on this kind of thing is a dangerous place. And I say that because of the civil liberties problems that it creates.
Well, I like the ruling because it didn't put an injunction. Mm-hmm. They didn't put an injunction. La Raza was seeking an injunction of the entire statute.
Didn't happen.
Or the entire bill. That did not happen. There were three provisions that were that was the case, and I think that's a good ruling.
Well, and I want to also just give a plug. I mean, the former Attorney General, Mark Shurtleff, that we, have look at and have concerns about, he was a leader in immigration reform. And my Jim's nodding, so I'm happy to see that there's a little bit of...
Look, it's very hard for me. I mean, I...
So what do you say? He fell off the rails earlier on, and we're just noticing now? Is that what happened
here?
Got
that issue right.
You know, we all knew Mark. You know, you cannot like Mark Shurtleff.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. In our next segment, we'll talk about Utah's Alcohol Control Commission and Oktoberfest.
I'm Jim DeBacchus on the left.
Greg Hughes on the right.
And Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. We learned this week that the state economists and forecasters for the legislature see us again finishing the budget year with a sizable surplus, somewhere in the neighborhood of, I love this range, 25 to 150 million. When I was an economist in state government, the ranges weren't that large. What did you guys hear yesterday, and how was it felt?
Great news. I think it's a validation of good conservative approach, fiscal conservatism in state government. Many states, they haven't seen a surplus since the pre-recession years. Utah has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. These kinds of surpluses that are being forecast, I think, are proof positive that we have good governance, that we are careful the way we budget and the way we commit future taxpayer dollars. And I'll tell you, these budget forecasters, they are throwing darts at a dartboard. They are so accurate. I mean, the way that they're able to predict these dollars coming in, and if they're ever wrong, it's always on the upside. They are so conservative that when we budget to a number, it has been lately that it is usually a higher number, if anything.
Greg's good friends in the fiscal analyst office are hearing
right.
To shout out.
Love those guys.
Jim, did you get a report on this as a Democrat?
Yeah, we got a report, but I just want to go back to Greg's analogy here. The way I throw darts at a dartboard, it could be anywhere. You know, you could be within 10 billion.
Yeah. So I'm not sure that was a compliment to the fiscal analyst.
No way. It is accurate. It is a bullseye. Let me tell you, if it's 25 to 150 million on the upside, what they're saying is, 25 million we know is the bottom. It could be as high as this, but they're still tempering expectations by having 25 million as the starting number of surplus. What a brilliant way to set a mindset. We know that people that look for these appropriations and look to see budgets improve, they budget to the number. They always do it. If it's a surplus year, that's the number they need. If it's a shortfall year, hold us harmless. It is the same process. They are tempering expectations, and I think that they help us manage. That's why we're the best managed state in the country.
Well, yeah, right. we're not going there. I want to say, though, that I think the staff is remarkable. The same staff that I was suing all the time when I was state party chair, they are remarkable people. They work hard. They're organized. They really are nonpartisan. I have nothing but respect for them. Now, as to the legislature, the big fiscal issue came out that surfaced yesterday was $1 billion in bonding, not for where we need it, not where we are in desperate need for funding.
Not for transportation?
Not for education. These gentlemen and ladies just cannot feed our roads enough money. Mm. To go out there for $1 billion when we need to be spending that money on Utah's future, not on Utah's roads, is a cataclysmic mistake, and it shows where the priorities of the legislature, where those priorities are. And I submit that if we're going to go out there for $1 billion, let's invest it in our children. And if we need more money for roads, let's do the right thing. Let's increase the gas tax, which has been stayed since the mid-90s at 24.5 cents a gallon, and let's make it a user tax instead of having this giant welfare plan to help people drive more cars and pollute more.
Yeah, and pass it on to our kids. You know, I mean, if you're borrowing, that's what you're doing.
So let me say this. These concepts aren't mutually exclusive. I think the gas tax has to be dealt with. I would prefer, instead of raising the hard cent per gallon any higher than it is, putting a percentage so that it doesn't get eaten away by inflation. Hemorrhaging money every year. And before we talk about growing it, let's stop losing money out of that fund. But on the topic of whether we bond or invest in these roads and the infrastructure, let me just say this. When I go and visit schools and I talk to students of any age about state government, I talk about our state income tax. And that state income tax is dedicated to education. So I ask the question, if unemployment goes up and people lose their jobs, what happens to the money for our schools? Kids and students intuitively say the money goes down. And if jobs are being created and we see people working, what happens to money for our schools? It goes up. You need infrastructure. We have a population that's going to double by 2040. If you're not planning for this, if you don't have those roads, that's where commerce is going to occur. You have to have a strong economy. Those roads are your lifeblood for a strong economy.
Greg,
therefore, money for education.
The
Jim.
Political center and economist and, you know, budget analyst in me wants to just say to you that what I saw happen over the last decade was something like this. We needed to rebuild I-15 in Utah County, I-15 core. We had no courage to raise the gas tax, so we borrowed a lot of money, and then we took a ton of sales tax, not a user fee, ton of sales tax. Legislature will often say, oh, everybody uses the roads and everybody pays sales tax. That's a user fee. Baloney. Has nothing to do with use. So then we passed it on to our kids. We took it out of the general fund. So then what happened? Well, we have higher ed just sitting there needing money to do what we need to help the economy, educate, you know, people. So what did higher ed do? Raise tuition. So how did we really pay for I-15 in Utah County, but on the backs of people that are trying to improve their lives through higher education?
Natalie, look at the tuition across the country. Utah is fortunate
this
to have as low of tuition as they do. We have Appalachian State in Pennsylvania, a college that no one's ever heard of. It's $100,000 after 4 years
of
tuition.
If I said I agree with you, meaning that tuition has been low, but right now, let's not do that anymore, and let's quit borrowing and quit using sales tax as much, and let's get that gas tax raised to pay for highways.
My only concern there is that I don't see user fees being able to fund, whether it be a fare to ride mass transit or your gas tax to repair or build roads, as the funding source that's going to accommodate for the kind of infrastructure we need. It's either a subsidy or an investment. We can call it either word. But it is going to be that, and we're going to need to find the dollars and the resources beyond gas tax and beyond the fare box recovery in mass transit to fund these projects to make sure that the commerce occurs, that people get from point A to point B, and that our economy continues to perform the way it does. A good economy is how dollars arrive for our schools. I mean, it's not what the politicians put on the bottom line of the ledger.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner. I'm joined by Jim DeBacchus and Greg Hughes. Jim, we got to talk about DABC, and I don't know where to start except to say that how is it that about every 3 to 6 months there's some big eruption down at DABC, our alcohol and beverage control place, where all of a sudden, the national media just ridicules Utah to have things like an Oktoberfest without beer.
You know, the best managed state from riveting from Swallow, pinging over to the state fair, continually going to this mess of a DABC. Let's get to the core here. We have an agency that is completely, absolutely out of control. It's a $300 million a year business trying to run retail, and they do all the buying. It's a complete monopoly. Everything Ayn Rand said would happen has happened with the DABC. It is one scandal after another throughout its history. There is no more riddled with scandal
fraud,
agency and state
intent
government.
To dine, Oktoberfest.
And
it just keeps coming.
And now, when the intent to dine issue came up 4 or 5 months ago, we brought before the Administrative Rules Committee. And I'd asked Chairman Stevenson if we could have this meeting, and I looked at everybody from the DABC, and I said, look, will you stop coming in here? You're shooting our state in the foot with your dumb, dumb, dumb things. What do? Got something through a change in their interpretation of the same rule that's been there since the 70s that made headlines. 7.5 million hits, 80 media agencies, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the headline was, Stupid Utah Taking the Beer Out of Oktoberfest, in 17 languages. So that $13.5 million that we spend on tourism, if you add up the value of the hit that the dummies at the DABC gave us, was 33% more in bad publicity than all the money we spend. Somebody has to look at the DABC and say, stop it, you
Greg,
people.
Doesn't the conservative view say maybe we should privatize this entity?
Sure, but I've changed my entire opinion about the DABC. I love this issue. I'm going to ask our producer, Tyler, to bring this issue up every single week because the veins that pop out of Jim's head when we bring this up, it's entertainment. I'm having a blast watching him. He's losing hair as we speak. It's falling from his head as he talks about the DABC. Here's the thing. I absolutely agree that we have – DABC is under a microscope globally for some reason. And Utahns, we have now – we have this inferiority complex. Let's just put it into context for just 1 second. I do not agree that you should have an Oktoberfest without beer. I don't know that who would agree with that. And I think we have to get drilled down to that. And I wish DABC was a little more sensitive of the optics. But remember this, Utahns. I grew up in Pittsburgh. That is a football town. That is a drinking town with a football problem. Okay? There is a lot of imbibing going on in the city of Pittsburgh. Growing up, and I think it's still the case, you could not walk into a grocery store, convenience store, anywhere that anyone under 21 could walk into that store and sell any kind of alcohol at all, beer, wine coolers, you name it, you could not. You have beer distributors who get licensed and can distribute, sell beer. You have liquor stores. There are laws like this across the country. Utah gets targeted on this, on our unique laws. We have to be careful about how we do it, and I agree. But let's not take this narrative and blame ourselves or think that we're somehow an aberration in this country. It is going on everywhere. And I say that when I arrived in Utah and I saw that you could go to a grocery store and buy a six-pack or a convenience store, that was far more liberal in terms of alcohol laws than in Pennsylvania as a state.
Yeah.
And so
we get a bad rap.
Yeah, let's keep it in perspective.
I'm in the political center here. I am a teetotaler. I do not drink alcohol. I do think that if you're going to regulate alcohol, you ought to know something about alcohol. And I would favor more people on the Alcohol Beverage Commission who are drinkers. And I would even say it should be a majority. And I'm just curious what the two of you think on that. Because right now it's a sizable minority, right?
Look, it's stakeholders. You have stakeholders. I think that it's a community that we all live in. We all have concerns. Everyone's voice ought to be heard. I think those that imbibe and those that enjoy a drink, an adult beverage, their perspective ought to be part of the equation. But certainly those that don't, their concerns ought to be heard as well. So I think it ought to be a good mix.
I think that Senator Mark Mattson from Utah County, maybe the most conservative member of the Senate.
I would agree.
Sat in our committee hearing, put up his hands and said, it's time to end this monopoly. We need to turn this over to private enterprise. This clearly isn't working. And I think that the state needs to begin to relinquish control, perhaps by setting up an enforcement division and a retail division. And it is truly a complete mess and has been for generations. But now Francine Gianni, who went in and tried to take over the latest mess, threw up her hands and said, this is really, really a mess. And we ought to recognize the state just can't run
it. It's a problem we can solve. Greg, it's time to go to gripes. You have a big smile on your face today, but you've always got some gripe tucked away. What's on your mind?
I'm going nationally this time, Natalie. Here's the thing. National news is saying that Lois Lerner from the IRS has lost 2 years. 2 years worth of emails. Oops, they're just gone. In Utah, we have a unique perspective about lost emails. We have emails from just a few months that disappeared from a former attorney, John Swallow. Come to find out, there's no such thing as a lost email. They were all recovered from hard drives or the cloud or whatever. There is no such thing as a lost email. If it's the case, and the IRS has actually accomplished this, I think that might be a landmark method of getting rid of information that no one else seems to be able to do. This charade needs to end. Lois Lerner probably perjured herself in front of a congressional hearing. She has to come clean, give those emails up, and quit saying silly things like, oh, I've lost 2 years worth. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
It's not real, and we know that.
Amen. And somehow you know the NSA has those.
Of course.
Jim.
We heard testimony yesterday. The sheriffs in rural Utah are upset because the BLM has cut their contracts. You know what? The chickens come home to roost. You start waving your fist and making goofy laws about federal agents on county land and the rest, they're gonna fight back. You spit in their face. The state needs to understand that ultimately we have a supremacy clause. The feds have control. We need to sit down as equal partners and stop all this ideology. One of the bad side effects of this is the BLM cutting the ties to the contracts for the sheriffs.
Okay, well, my gripe is kind of wonky, and I got to think about how to say this in a way that is understandable. But I have a gripe as someone who worked in a budget office for 18 years that whenever we have a surplus, that legislators and the news media and everybody interprets this as the economy is doing so much better. And the real definition of a surplus is it's really forecast error. It means that whoever was making those forecasts underestimated what was going to come in, and so we end up with a surplus. And being someone who's done those forecasts before, you have every incentive as the economist making those forecasts to underestimate them, because it's so much harder to deal with a shortage than it is a surplus. And so I'm excited for surpluses to actually just be more of a forecasting error, and let's let economic measures tell us what's going on in the economy. What do you guys think?
See, I love it when
you're
Natalie,
right. You're absolutely
wonky.
Right. Wonkish. Wonkish.
You've been listening.
I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner. I've been joined by State Senator Jim DeBacchus and State Representative Greg Hughes. Thank you for listening.